It is good to address you today. I enjoy expositing texts, and I promise when I come back in April, if the Lord tarries, I'll exposit a text. But I also enjoy doing biographical sketches with you that teach lessons. Last spring, we did Obadiah Holmes from 18th century American Baptist history, and I wish to address a couple of 18th century Baptists again this hour. And whenever we do these, there is an intentional lesson that we're trying to draw from the story. And that lesson is that our actions have consequences. We can easily begin to think that what we do really doesn't matter. Now, this can be a very negative lesson, and we could give you plenty of examples, biblically and from church history, that say, you know what, your actions have consequences, so don't mess up. But I'd kind of like to have a positive thrust today. And so our text is from Zechariah, where Haggai and Zechariah are preaching that the temple will be rebuilt. This is after the return from exile. And many who remembered the Temple of Solomon are saying, well, we're never going to be able to build something like that glorious structure. This is just pathetic. And God says through Zechariah, hey, despise not the day of small things. That is, it may seem small now, but you don't know what God's going to take and do with that. And that word that seems insignificant now, we say it through the power of the Spirit because we love God, and the effects may just go on and on. I'm calling it this morning the ripple effect, and that's the best picture I could find on Google Images of a ripple. So there it is. So we do matter, and our actions can have consequences, and God can do things through us. And that should have the effect of causing us to, by faith, make wise choices, take strong stands, be godly. I'd like to give you two examples of that. Two gentlemen that are not as familiar as some that I've done Isaac Watts here with you, and we've done other great leaders. Henry Dunster is not as well known as I think he should be, and so we're going to rectify that over the next 15 minutes. And then we're going to talk about a man by the name of Elias Keach. You say, well, how can you fit two of them into the chapel hour? Well, we don't know much about either man. That is, we're not going to, you know, talking about what toothbrushes he used because we just don't know. All right, but we are going to look at the main stroke of their life. And I believe both of these lives will illustrate for us the effect that decisions can make centuries later as we move forward. So shaking up the establishment, Henry Dunster. He was born about 1612. I say about because even that we're not too sure about. We don't know anything about his parents. We don't know anything about his siblings. We don't know anything about his upbringing. It was probably in a fairly well-to-do home because he's going to get into Cambridge. And he's going to study there, and that's for sort of the upper classes in England. Furthermore, as we move forward in the story, he's going to be a man of some means, and we're never going to really be able to discover how he came into those means. After all, he was a preacher, and preachers are not usually men of means. So he goes to Cambridge, and he is just ridiculously bright. That is, by the time he's 22, he has completed the equivalent of what we would call a master's degree. He is the outstanding Orientalist among the students of the day, which means he knew Hebrew and the cognate Semitic languages extremely well. He was a master of the Jewish intertestamental writings, the various Targums, the Midrash. He just knew it all. He was, of course, an expert in Greek. He was just a brilliant man. And so he could have named his spot in the Anglican Church except for one thing. And that is that while he was at Cambridge, he became a Puritan. Now, this is 1634, and you know from the American history, which is still very fresh in your minds, that starting about 1629, 1630, Puritans started fleeing England. Why? Because the archbishop at the time was a man by the name of William Laud, and William Laud hated Puritans, and he was exercising his authority to persecute them right and left. He graduated. We're not sure what he did for the next few years. But God was preparing a place for him, because over in the colonies, about this time, Massachusetts Bay decided to start their own school. 2 years after Dunster graduated from Cambridge, they laid the foundations for Harvard College. Why did they want a college in New England? Because they didn't want to send their young men back to Oxford and Cambridge to study under William Laud and his cronies. That is, these schools were falling under the control of the anti-Puritans. So they started their own school, and they were able to endow it through a man by the name of John Harvard. I'll say a little more about that in the next slide. And they found a president to run the school, and his name was Nathaniel Eaton. Now, when I say president, he was pretty much president, professor, bottle washer. He ran the school because they didn't have a faculty and they didn't have that many students. So Nathaniel Eaton, run this school for us. Now, what you may or may not know about Harvard is that when this school was founded, it was founded to train preachers of the gospel. Here's the official statement of that, their mission statement. After God had carried us safe to New England, and we had, and you see they need a college, they can't even spell the word we, all right? And we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government. One of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity. Dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. That's the purpose of the school. So they explain how this all came together. And as we were thinking and consulting how to effect this great work, it pleased God to stir up the heart of one Mr. Harvard, a godly gentleman and a lover of learning, then living amongst us, to give one half of his estate, it being in all about 1,700 pounds, towards the erecting of a college and all his library. After him, another gave 300 pounds. Others after them casted more, and the public hand of the state added the rest. That would be taxes. But it was a good cause. The college was, by common consent, appointed to be at Cambridge. Cambridge was a suburb, if you will, of Boston, a place very pleasant and accommodate, and is called, according to the name of the first founder, Harvard College. So we've got a school. Unfortunately, Nathaniel Eaton ended up being a lousy choice. That is, he was extremely unpopular with the students. He was not a good lecturer. He was a stern disciplinarian. And no sooner did they start gathering some students than Eaton started running them off. And after the first 4 years, it didn't look like the school was going to survive, that it was going to abort within just the first few years of existence. And so at the end of the 1639 school year, they fired him. Now they've got to find another president. Well, in 1640, God laid it on Henry Dunster's heart to go to America. As far as I can tell, now I could be wrong about this, but based on the existing records, we don't read of correspondence between the managers of Harvard and Dunster. It's not like they said, hey, there's this scholar in Britain who would be perfect. I mean, after all, Dunster was in his late 20s at the time. You don't usually turn over a college to a guy in his 20s. So this appears to be simply a providence thing, all right, and God's been known to do this. He sends Dunster to America. He arrives, and as they begin to interact with him, they find out what a scholar he is, and they offer him the position of president of Harvard. There was one sticky wicket, though, and that is that during his interview, he said, you know, guys, there's one thing that might bother you about me. I've studied this word baptizo in the Greek New Testament, and it means immerse. It doesn't mean sprinkle. It doesn't mean pour. It means immerse. And so I'm not sure that your religious system is right when you sprinkle water on a baby's forehead and say it's baptized. I'm just not sure about that. However, I do believe covenant theology overall is sound, and if a baptism is a key component of that, so I'm willing to accept the system as long as you don't mind my sharing my reservations with the students about how we translate the word baptizo. And they said, well, okay, you know, they weren't too terribly concerned about that. And he became President Dunster, 28-year-old man. He proceeded to pour himself into building Harvard. He took of his own means and he purchased property near where they had planted the school. And he, with his own money, built a house for the president. He purchased a printing press and installed it in the basement of his house. And he began to produce his own curricula, finding good books in England, writing his own books, printing them himself in his basement, and providing the textbooks for the students. He taught the entire curriculum. The students thought he was awesome. That is, he was a great teacher. He could teach virtually every subject that a school at that time needed to offer, and he could do so with a high level of competence. They established a campus chapel, and he became the campus preacher. I mean, who else is going to do it? And he was a great preacher. And people from the community, there was a parish church in Cambridge, but sometimes people from the community would come to the campus to hear President Dunster preach in the campus chapel. And his reputation began to spread across New England. Nobody in New England is smarter than this Dunster guy. That is, if there's a question about the Hebrew text or the intertestamental period or the Greek text or a theological question, if you want it answered, you ask Professor Dunster. Harvard was getting a reputation as a place to go to get answers. If he died at the age of 39, 1651, he would still be fairly famous as the man who established Harvard. Harvard University today, which is nothing like the Harvard he led, still honors his memory as their principal founder and leader. And of course, you know what Harvard is today. It's a big mess of false teaching. But you can still get a good education in some fields, I suppose. I'd prefer Mayor Naffer. But something happened in 1651 that changed everything. Obadiah Holmes, who we discussed last February, was a Baptist down in Rhode Island who, along with Pastor John Clark and John Crandall, came up to Lynn, Massachusetts, just outside Boston to the south. Cambridge is a little bit to the north. And they held a Baptist church service and were arrested. And after lying in prison for weeks, they took Holmes out into Boston Common and whipped him mercilessly. Left him a bloody wreck. He couldn't sleep on his back for months. And Dunster probably personally witnessed this. We don't know for sure. What we do know is that Dunster is going to later say, when I saw the religious establishment whipping a man because of his religious beliefs, and furthermore, those beliefs were not that different from my own. That is, he believed that somebody should be baptized by immersion. That's the main crime that these Baptists are committing, and we're whipping them in the streets. Dunster said there's got to be something wrong with that. And he started working on the question. Did I mention that he was a really smart man and that he knew the Bible really well? Well, he started working on the question. And what he discovered when he studied the scriptures was, oh no, the Baptists are right. That's sort of what he discovered. Within 2 years, he began announcing in his classroom that, you know what? Infant baptism is not just a harmless alternative, it is unscriptural. It is wrong. So he preached a whole series of sermons in the college campus chapel saying, infant baptism and all the doctrines related to this system are based on faulty premises and are wrong. And then his wife had a baby. Scholars argue whether this is the second or third baby in the child. He had previously had children who had been sprinkled. But just as he's investigating this question, a new baby is born, and he says to the parish at Cambridge, I will not bring this baby to be sprinkled. That was a crime. Or it was against the law not to bring your baby to be sprinkled. It placed you under church discipline. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to debate with him and prove to him that he's wrong. Well, good luck with that. That is, there's nobody in New England who knows the Greek and Hebrew like Dunster does. That is, this really shook up the establishment. How can this man, who understands the scriptures so well, be getting this fundamental doctrine so wrong? And so many of them were just outraged. And Dunster had to know that when he expressed this scholarly opinion, it was going to have repercussions. It had wide repercussions. He was forced to resign from the presidency of Harvard. They fired him after being president for 13 years. They expelled him from Cambridge. Now, what that means is they kicked him out of his own house. He had built that house with his own money. He had donated the land. And Harvard said, well, it's ours now, and you're fired, so get. He came under church discipline. And you say, well, why expel him and then put him under church discipline? Because the Church of Cambridge wanted to formally censure his teachings so that he would be under church discipline and unable to join another New England church until he repented of his apostasy. And then he moved to Scituate Plymouth Colony. I don't know why he didn't move to Rhode Island. The fact of the matter is, Dunster never formally joined a Baptist church. That is, he never took that last step. Baptist historians are not sure why. What we do know is that the authorities would not leave him alone. That is, they passed several writs of arrest against him. He was finally dragged before a grand jury and required to testify in 1657. He would not budge despite the persecution. They didn't want to throw him in jail. He was revered across the colony as this brilliant man. And while they were trying to figure out what to do with him, he got sick and died. He was 46 or 47 years old. And he's gone. You say, well, what a sad story. Yeah, and isolated, it doesn't seem like it. I mean, it's one guy, one stand, one place in the middle of a religious system that will not allow dissent. What possibly could come from this? But Baptists across New England, who were largely viewed as lower class, kind of disenfranchised people, they saw this Harvard genius doing this, and they were greatly emboldened. And so let me tell you what happened. These are the ripples. Some of them. God only knows all the ripples. One of the men who was inspired by Dunster was a guy by the name of Thomas Gould. Thomas Gould lived in Boston, and Gould was one of those ordinary people who just wasn't going to do what a false religious system told him to do. And he said, you know what? Most of the Baptists have moved to Rhode Island, but I'm not leaving Boston. And he talked with Dunster and became convinced by Dunster that infant baptism was unscriptural. And as soon as his wife started having babies, he started refusing to bring any of them for baptism. He got kicked out of the church, so he started a church in his home. He got dragged off to jail multiple occasions, at least three or four times. He was imprisoned by the authorities. But by the time he died, there was a First Baptist Church in Boston. That wasn't officially organized for a few years after his death. But Gould is considered the planter of that church. Well, one of the members of that church was a guy by the name of William Screven. And William Screven heard the gospel at First Baptist Church. And he was a businessman who said, you know, I'd like to go do business outside Boston because I think I can do better. And I'll carry the gospel with me when I do. And he moved to Maine as a missionary from First Baptist Church. He planted a church in Maine, in Kittery, Maine, and he experienced persecution there. And after a few years of persecution, over a dozen years of persecution, he decided, you know what? There's got to be a better place to have a church. And he moved from Maine to South Carolina, and most of his church sailed with him. And the Kittery Church just relocated to Charleston, South Carolina, and established First Baptist Church of Charleston. It was the first Baptist church anywhere south of the Mason-Dixon line. It's going to be the most influential church in the South for the next 125 years. In fact, when Baptists finally organized nationally to support Adoniram and Ann Judson, the first president of the Triennial Convention is going to be Richard Furman. And Richard Furman was the pastor of First Baptist Church of Charleston, South Carolina. If you go to First Baptist Church today, you can see the graves of William Screven and Richard Furman right outside the church in the church grounds. In other words, one man's stand swept across American religious history and shaped the Baptist denomination. Let me talk about a second man. We even know less about him, but I'll entitle this little sketch, Playing with a Lion. The story of Elias Keach. Elias Keach, we do know where he was born. That's one advantage over Dunster. He was born in Buckinghamshire, England. 1667. Now, to put this in context, this is 8 years after Dunster's death. That is the year that Thomas Gould passed away. Actually, Gould died in 68. So the First Baptist Church of Boston is just about in formation at this time. And this young man, Elias Keach, is born. Well, I say famous family there. Why? Because his dad was Benjamin Keach. And maybe I'll do Benjamin Keach in a chapel someday, but he was a great Baptist leader of the 17th century. He pastored one of the leading churches in the city of London. He is the man who introduced congregational hymn singing to the Baptists. They had been afraid of music up until Keach came along. Great church, big church. Elias grew up in that church. And like a lot of teenagers who are PKs, he said, man, I hate being in the fishbowl. I hate being Benjamin Keach's son. I hate everybody knowing who I am. I got to get away from this place. And so he saved up some money. And at 19 years old, he decided to leave London and leave the Keach legacy behind and go somewhere where he could be himself. He didn't have to meet anybody's requirements. And so he sailed to America. He arrived, New York Harbor, made his way across the Raritan Valley to Philadelphia. And lo and behold, we don't know the details, he met some Scotch-Irish Baptists there. And he made the big mistake of introducing himself. And they said, "Keach, are you related to the great Benjamin Keach of London?" He goes, "Yeah, well, yeah, that would be me." And they said, "Well, we need a pastor. We've got all these settlers who have outrun the learned ministry, and we've established little communities here in the Philadelphia area, but we don't have anybody to preach to us. There's only one settled pastor in the whole community, and he's way up north at Cold Spring." They said, "Would you be our pastor?" And Keach said, "Yeah, I could do that. I know bunches of my dad's sermons. Wouldn't be a problem." And so he decided to don his clerical robes and pull out his dusty Bible, and he preached. Let me tell you the story here in the words of Morgan Edwards, the church historian who captured this story for us. Edwards wrote, "He performed well enough till he advanced pretty far in his sermon." So this actually makes it sound like the very first time he got up to preach. Then, stopping short, looked like a man astonished. The audience concluded he had been seized with a sudden disorder. But on asking what the matter was, received from him a confession of the imposture, with tears in his eyes and much trembling. Great was his distress, though it ended happily, for from this time he dated his conversion. In other words, Elias Keach got saved in the middle of his own sermon. It's happened at other times in church history. It's not a common occurrence. So what's he going to do now? Well, there was that one church up at Cold Spring. And so he traveled up there and met the pastor. The pastor there was Thomas Dungan. Good man. Dungan baptized Keach. And Dungan's idea was, "I'll mentor this young man and train him, and maybe after a while he'll be ready to be involved in ministry." What Dungan forgot was that Keach had grown up in the church. He knew the Bible backwards and forwards. I mean, at the beginning of chapel, he could have just rattled off the references. And so after about a year and a half under Pastor Dungan, Dungan said, "Hey, I think you're ready, son." And he went to Pinnipeck. Pinnipeck Baptist Church is still there. It's in northeastern Philadelphia, about 13 miles from the city center. It's the oldest existing Baptist church in Pennsylvania. I can't tell you whether they're preaching the gospel or not. Churches don't necessarily advertise that they aren't. But he planted this church and started preaching to him and pouring his life into them. And then he began traveling around the area, finding other groups of Scotch-Irishmen and establishing them as congregations. And pretty soon he was the pastor of five small congregations, all in the Philadelphia area. Furthermore, he went down into New Jersey and ministered extensively. The historians tell us that he poured himself into the work and became just a dynamic preacher. But, you know, humans are humans. And after 4 years of ministering in this environment, he got into a conflict with his church over the laying on of hands, where they disagreed with each other on whether to receive members by laying on of hands or not. And he said, "You know what? I haven't seen Dad in a long time. I think I'll go back to London." And he headed back to London, 1692. He planted a Baptist church in another segment of London. And such were his ministerial gifts, his preaching gifts, and the blessing of God, of course, that pretty soon he had a church of over 1,500 gathered in London. You say, 1,500 Baptists in London? The persecution had just ended. That is, the persecution lasted right up until William and Mary came over in 1688. And in 1689, an act of toleration was passed. In 1691, a Bill of Rights was passed. And by 1692, people who had been hiding for fear of persecution were gathering to churches like this. And He had a beautiful reunion with his dad, and he and Benjamin collaborated on producing a confession of faith, one of the great Baptist confessions. And just as his ministry was beginning to thrive, and we could be talking about him as one of the early Spurgeons of Baptist history, he got sick and died at the age of 34. And he's gone. Any ripples? Those five churches, tiny little churches. When I say churches, I mean 30 to 40 people each. Those five churches in the Philadelphia area, all of them survived. All of them got pastors. And they all began to fellowship with one another and to coordinate activities and to say, if we're going to send out missionaries to evangelize the colonies, we're going to have some level of fellowship. And so they established in 1707, 6 years after his death, what became known as the Philadelphia Association. This was the first association of Baptist churches in America, and it is going to be by far the most important association in American Baptist history. They're going to send missionaries all over the colonies. Everything important that happens with Baptists for the next 100 years is going to have something to do with Philadelphia. It's going to be the headquarters of Baptist church life. Keach could not have known that when he decided to play charades and pretend to be a preacher. Furthermore, in 1742, they adopted the Keach Confession as the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. And that became the most influential confession of faith in Baptist circles until the middle 19th century, when the New Hampshire Confession succeeded it. What's the point? Well, the point is not that you and I are going to be Henry Dunsters. Probably nobody in the room is going to be. And it would be really cool if one of you got saved during one of your own sermons later, but I'd rather you be saved now. So that's not the point. The lesson is that what you and I are doing today will have effects tomorrow. And that's maybe one of the clearest lessons from Scripture. What a man sows, that will he also reap. But we usually talk about sowing and reaping in pretty negative terms. And the Scriptures teach that sowing and reaping can be a gloriously positive truth. What are we sowing today? Through our words, our actions, our obedience, the stands we take? What are we sowing today that God could take and multiply in ways we never imagined? Because God's in the business of doing that. And these are a few examples of how he has in the past. Let's close in prayer. Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity this morning to consider Henry Dunster and Elias Keach. We wish we knew more about these men. What we know excites us about the grace of God and how you stiffened the backbone of Henry Dunster when it would have been so easy to compromise and to just let go his convictions, and how you transformed the whole direction of Elias Keach's life. Lord, he was playing with a lion when he opened the Scriptures and pretended to preach. And thank you that that lion overcame him and brought him to submission and then used him in such a magnificent way. And Lord, I pray that we would never think that our contributions are insignificant. If they are done in your will and in obedience to your command, you can take and do so much more with them than we would ever be capable of. Give us hearts, Lord, to trust you and be obedient. And I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.